I'm more American than you. I'm more America. That's you. I'm more America. That's you. I'm more America. That's you.
All right. Hey, it's Greg Gutfeld. I'm here with the one being me. I've got a very exciting guest. You know what's interesting about my guest? He's one of the greatest drummers in the world. He was in probably one of the greatest bands ever, The Police. But he's probably the least interesting person in his family. That's what's amazing to me about Stuart Copeland. Hey, Stuart, how are you?
Yeah, I'm kind of the runt of the litter.
You are. I don't know if people realize the background of where you came from. I mean, you're
still trying to figure that out.
Because you know what?
Even more important, where did I end up?
Exactly. Your dad, Miles Copeland, such an interesting person, because I think I've read his stuff in the 80s, because I was at National Review.
The Game of Nations.
Yeah. He was a musician, but he was also a secret agent who was involved in several major coups. Is that accurate?
Major and a couple more minor ones, too.
Yes. Syria? Iran?
Syria and Egypt were his two main theaters. He knocked out a couple of Syrian governments. But his big hit was Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, where he and the Roosevelt cousins, they conspired to put this guy in office.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing about him was that he became a leader of what became known as the Third World, the non-aligned movement. You know, there was a Cold War going on, and the Ruskies had their guys, and the West, we had our people, and the oil was there, so we needed to keep the Arab world sweet because we needed that oil.
Mm-hmm.
And Egypt, so we put our guy in Egypt, and he was, he used to say, down with America and all this stuff, coached by his American CIA handlers.
Wow.
At the same time as taking our salt and taking over the non-aligned movements. And there was poor old Tito and Gaddafi and all the rest of them wondering, what keeps going wrong here? And it was our guy in Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser.
Wow. That is such an amazing story. I've read a bit about your dad, and it's interesting that he had perhaps – what you're talking about in this kind of the old world was that there were certain realities that I don't think can fly today. Like when you tell that story, people are like, I can't believe that. But that's
well,
how you –
forget about the Cold War because nobody died. Nobody's father is lost.
Right.
There's no blood. There's no beautiful cemetery or anything like that. But it was a war, and it appears not to be over.
No, not at all. Your dad, he basically joined what later became the CIA, I guess, probably in the 40s,
yes,
right after World War II. Is this why your band's called The Police?
No. Except that my brother Miles, son of Miles Ax Copeland II, the spy,
mm-hmm,
was my brother Miles, manager and mogul, entertainment mogul,
right,
who started IRS Records with the Go-Go's, R.E.M.
The Cramps.
The Cramps, Bangles, you know.
Yeah.
He had his own thing there.
Yeah.
And he, you know, since The Police was such a cool, snippy name, he thought, ha, 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 how about I call my record company IRS? And my other brother, Ian, also thought, well, he'll call his company FBI. And funny story. My brother Ian, who's the most amazing of the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
He's the Viet Vet cool dude of the family, Leroy Cool Breeze. He's sitting at his desk after hours at his agency, and the receptionist gone home and phone rings, and Ian picks up and, hello, Ian Copeland, FBI. And the voice in the other line says, no, this is the FBI.
What did
he
do?
He said, hey, look, if you want to come down here, if you can find anybody down here impersonating a federal officer, take them off.
Ted, what did he actually do for a living?
Me?
No, him.
Ian?
Yeah.
Well, he was an agent.
Oh, okay.
He single-handedly created the new wave circuit in America. He first brought over a band called Squeeze.
Right.
He went around to all the cities, you know, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Boston, all these different cities, and found the strangest-looking kid on the street with the worst hair and said, where do the punks hang out? And they said, well, we don't have anywhere to hang out. Well, so you go find a club and say, how about if every Thursday you have punk night? And the club owner says, what's that? He says, just try it. Thursday night, punk night. And Ian would send in a band with bad hair and bad attitude, playing too loud, too fast.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks would show up. The kids who didn't want to be hippies, they want to be anything else, would go down there on Thursday night to the Rat Club in Boston or the garbage pit in Philadelphia or whatever, you know, these clubs. And so they created, and the second band over was the Police.
Right.
And we played this kind of circuit that my brother Ian created. Then there was, you know, B-52s, Talking Heads. I mean, he represented all those bands. His roster goes three pages of all those new wave bands that he represented.
You just described my entire teenage years. I saw the Police in, I think it was 78, 79, at Zeller back at Berkeley. You guys didn't have
it. I was there.
You were. Do you remember?
I was there too.
Do you remember who opened? Do you remember who opened for you?
Yes, I do. The Knack.
Exactly. And they were good, weren't they?
They were fantastic.
Yes.
Really tight.
Yes.
Skinny Tie Music.
Yeah, and I'd never heard of them, and then they're out. Their album hadn't come out yet.
Sharona.
Yeah, they were.
You know, we met Sharona in Japan. We ran across their paths later, and by that time they'd had a big hit. And there in the, I think it was either the airport or the hotel lobby, there's Sharona. Hi, I'm Sharona.
Wow. Isn't that great to have a song named after you?
Well, she was enjoying it.
Yeah, I'm sure she was. You also had a guitarist that opened up named Robert Johnson. He's like a young white, he's a white Robert Johnson. A session player, but he had a
He must be such a disappointment when he walks in the room.
Yeah, I know. This is Robert.
Walks in with his guitar. People go, oh.
Oh. But he was really good. He just disappeared. He had one album, and I can't remember the name of it. But if you Google Robert Johnson, he had a song called Curiosity. I can't remember anything else. But he was like a dorky new wave guy. You don't even remember him. He opened for the Knack. He was the first.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That's going back into the mist there. The opener for the opener for the opener.
Yeah.
One lesson I learned in show business.
What?
Be nice to your support act because they're going to be huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we were touring back in the day, and there's this really fun band on the road with us, the Go-Go's.
Yes.
And, oh, they just jumped on the stage. Those five women, they just lit it up.
Yeah.
And folks love it. They had great songs and everything. And during the course of the tour, their album hit the charts.
Yeah.
And then it started going up the charts. And then it started catching up with our record in the charts. And fortunately, the tour ended about 2 weeks before their album went to number one and knocked us out.
Wow.
So be nice to your support act, and do let them use the subwoofers.
Yeah, your poor. I saw you guys at the Cow Palace, and your poor support act was a great band called the Fleshtones. I love the Fleshtones.
Fleshtones, yeah.
Yeah, and they got heckled, and they had, you know, because they're, you know when.
You know who got heckled the worst?
Who?
The Cramps.
Oh, I love the Cramps. They're my favorite.
I love the Cramps. They were fantastic,
yes.
But our nice audience didn't like them too much.
Yeah.
We'd get, you know, after their set, the crew hated them because they'd have to go and hose down all the slime and tomatoes and rotten eggs and bile that had been thrown at this provocative band.
They were so awesome. I saw them, and then I actually went to their house for a story. And
they have a house?
Yeah. It was in Glendale.
Like in a cave,
yes.
Or up a tree somewhere, hanging upside down.
It looked. It was like how the Munsters lived, but it was well appointed,
yeah.
And it was by a cemetery. It was back. This had to be 12 years ago.
Yeah, Luxenterian Ivy.
Yes.
What was her name?
Ivy Rorschach. Ivy Rorschach. Poison,
yeah.
Ivy Rorschach. And they had a couple of interesting guitarists. Remember early times, it was Brian Gregory.
Brian Gregory,
yes.
The smiliest looking guy on the planet. They
yes.
were an amazing band.
Scary.
And the drummer, Nick Knox, was it?
Nick Knox. And
he'd just sit there looking totally cool, like one of the guys in The Godfather. He wouldn't play any drum fills or...
No.
I don't think he even had any cymbals. He'd just go boom, ba, boom,
yes.
Bah, you know.
He played drums with one hand,
yeah.
And would just drink a beer in the other and just look straight ahead. And then there was the guy from the Gun Club.
He completely fulfill his full function.
Yes.
As providing the throb. So it did do his throb.
Yes, that's true. And then there was Kid Congo Powers. He was in there for a little bit. Do you remember him? He was
never saw him.
Yeah, he was sitting in the Gun Club, and then he went into the Cramps. He's still around. But that was they were one of the most dangerous and fun bands. If you had the joy to see them in that early 80s,
yeah.
Oh, my God. Just
bring a raincoat.
Yeah, he was always naked by the end of the show.
Halfway his pants. It was a miracle of engineering, you know. He didn't even have a pair of boobs to hold it up.
No, he didn't.
Something else holding up his pants.
Yeah, and he also used to do – he would do drugs on stage from the audience. He would just ask for the drugs. People would hand it to him, and he would just do it right there and then continue.
Unwise.
Yes, exactly.
But I think that sort of was our luck. Wisdom was not his strong suit.
Yes, I think so. The poor guy.
Provocative. When he'd go out there, he would go out there on a mission to get everybody screaming and, you know.
Yeah, he was great.
In joy or rage, never mind.
Now, did you expect – well, let me put it this way. When I was going to ask you if you ever thought of becoming a spy because a band would provide great cover. You could actually be – because I noticed how you –
I've been accused of it.
That's what I was – I'm accusing you right now. It's possible you might have worked for intelligence.
Are you kidding? That stuff's dangerous. Yeah. All I got to do is go play a show.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a lot harder work, bang, you know, chopping wood for 2 hours. But, you know, my father would have a drink in one hand while doing the day's work.
Yeah. What – did you –
but he's had a couple shots fired at him. You know, my sister's got the – Persian rug with the bullet holes.
Really?
Time they staged it. Get this.
Yeah.
So they're in Syria. It was before I was born. My mother was pregnant with my brother Ian, the vet cool agent dude. And they, you know, their guy, their puppet government guy, Hazni al-Hazul or Ahmad al-Wazab or whatever his name was, was just starting to put on airs. He took a couple, you know, he was starting to talk to the Soviets. You know, we got – this guy's a problem. We got to get our good buddy, Colonel Fuad Shahid al-Wahhab, in there instead. So they figure, okay, let's stage like a mob scene, like a – let's have a mob show up and attack an American diplomat's house. And then they call out the army. And while the army's out, they take over the palace and the radio station, and we got our guy in there, you know, back to business. And so they're there, and the mob shows up late, you know. And they start shooting. And my father's calling Beirut, you know, head off, say, look, the mob showed up here. It's getting a little bit, oh, wait a minute. I'm going to have to hang up now. They're shooting at me personally.
Wow. Incredible. What do you make of today?
And by the way, I don't get that problem in rock and roll.
No, you don't. You get different shots.
Yeah.
That's for sure. What do you make of the world today? I mean, you look at the Middle East. What's going on in Syria? And I mean, you know, you have a perspective. You have a family experience. I mean,
doom.
Doom.
The answer to your question that I think you're headed towards.
Yeah.
I think whatever specific question, the answer is doom.
Right.
You know, we had a couple world wars over in Europe, and before that, the Hundred Years' War, and all kinds of wars to figure ourselves out in Europe. And we finally got this European Union with one currency, and we're not at each other's throats anymore. Middle East has been kept secure. My daddy, I'm proud to say, kept the lid on the Middle East for his half century.
Mm-hmm.
Up until 9/11, you could almost say the lid was on the Middle East with their cutthroat dictators and banditos and generalissimos and royalty families that they put in position and everything. It kept security and the oil flowing for half a century.
Yeah.
But during that time, they invented this thing called the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And those people who are quite happy to till their fields and tend their flocks, as long as the boss is the boss, the Mukhtar is the boss, and nobody even questions it. What's political freedom? What's that?
Mm-hmm.
And why? As long as everything is secure. But then they get knowledge of the world outside and all the cool toys that can be had and are being enjoyed by those people on the other side of the world, and they even get to say something about it. That system that lasted for half a century cannot prevail.
Yeah.
And in fits and starts, bit by bit, it's already started.
Mm-hmm.
But World War Middle East is upon us.
Yeah.
They've got to sort this stuff out. And they have so many rivalries and interests and supplied by outside forces and so on. It's going to get dark before they see any light, I think. It's really tragic because I identify with the Arab people. I grew up amongst them. I love them. They are my brothers, and I wish it were not so, but there's some stuff they've got to go through.
Yeah, and you know, it's what you said about all these different factions. I mean, right now I'm in the New York Times, ISIS just is fighting the Taliban. I mean, what side do you take at that point?
Well, it's confusing.
Yeah.
You know, the good guys are the bad guys, and the bad guys are the good guys. And here's a common scenario. My country where I grew up, Lebanon, I was born in America, but I left when I was 2 months old because my father was busy doing his thing.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Lebanon, in Beirut. And the scene would be that the Christian warlords would beat up on some Shia. And they stall looking bad. So Syria comes in to protect the Shia from the Christian warlords. Next thing they know, the Shia are shooting the Syrians in the back, because now that they're all protected by the Syrian army, hey, let's go beat up some Christians, and they start fighting again.
Mm-hmm.
And so as what the motif that you can look for in the Middle East is some poor people are getting beat up on. Yeah. Let's go help those poor people. You go help the poor people, whether it's Syria helping the poor people or the United States helping the poor people or Turkey or Russia. First thing those poor people start doing when they're not poor anymore, start shooting their protectors in the back.
Right. Oh, man. It's like it is so – and I think, you know, what your dad was when I said he was a realist, he was aware of the irrationality of the people and that political repression at a minimum. I mean, there had to be
not irrationality. I mean, yeah. they have the same dose of irrationality that we have over here.
Right.
But a more limited – source of information, and we're all irrational, Greg.
I agree completely. I agree. What I was getting at is that we're.
I am anyway.
I know. I was, but it was kind of like what you were saying about how I don't know. You had some really bad people that kept people down because they thought that was the only way to do it, and now it's just not working.
Well, it's not so much that they kept people down, mm-hmm. as the people were already down. They were
right.
just living their medieval lives,
right?
While the king sits upon his throne and all is secure across the land. That's
right.
sort of their idea of the perfect political system.
Yeah.
What my father used to call benign dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally you get a young prince who gets up on the throne and turns out to be a cheese bag.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to just suffer that until his son comes along. You know, they're kind of fatalistic when it comes to their political system. It is what it is, inshallah.
Yeah. How do we deal with...
And by the way, that was then. I'm not talking about the modern Arab person.
Right.
That's sort of what was still... While we were all being enlightened and democratizing and inventing new systems of governance and everything, they still pretty much in that medieval world.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does the West deal with ISIS? I mean,
not physically.
Yeah,
you deal with them intellectually, which that's the wrong word. You deal with them with what we do best, which is messaging. It's unbelievable that we're losing the message war with them.
Right.
And I think the reason we're losing the persuasion war, and that's the only thing that works, the San Bernardino folks, the folks in England,
mm-hmm.
those weren't trained by ISIS over in there because they were holding land. They were inspired by the ideas.
Right.
It's those ideas that we've got to deal with. Sure, we got to stamp out their caliphate, that physical thing, but that's pretty much a side issue. And by the way, once we've stamped out that caliphate, our main threat will not dissipate one bit.
Mm-hmm.
When the caliphate is gone, we will still have this kind of terrorism in our midst. And the way to combat it is in the city of Bradford in England and, you know, in Detroit, and, you know, to bring those people onto our side. They're us. They're in our boat with us. And we have a much more powerful argument that if you've arrived, you know, in England, we do have something in America that it's taken them a minute to pick up on in Europe. And it's kind of icky, but our politically correct acceptance of each other, regardless, we are, you know, it's part of our American religion. We shall not, you know, discriminate by mm-hmm. race, color, or creed. And, you know, it gets a bit icky sometimes, but that's the reason why somebody arrives from Vietnam
mm-hmm.
or from Afghanistan or Syria or Germany or England, and the first thing they hear when they get here is, you are American.
Mm-hmm.
You are American now. And they kind of say, wow, gosh, I like this place. Oh, yeah, they put on a baseball cap and mm-hmm. start following baseball, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't happen in Europe. If you're
brown
in England,
yeah.
you're not a descendant of Henry VIII,
yeah.
for which you sort of need that pedigree to truly be British.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken the Europeans a while to figure out that they have these huge, diverse populations, some of whom are not told that they are of this country. So that kid in Bradford, screw this place. Nobody ever told me this is my country.
Mm-hmm.
Let's blow it up.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, though, that it's also, I mean, part of a resistance to assimilate is, I mean,
they did try something in Europe
yeah.
called multiculti, and I feel that with the best of intentions, it was a failure,
mm-hmm.
which was to say, let all the different tribes in our nation express themselves in their own neighborhoods, in their own way, mm-hmm. and so on. And we will celebrate this diversity. It's a really great idea to let the people from Pakistan settle in whatever city and set up little miniature Pakistan there. And we enjoy their food, their culture, their music, everything that they bring with them from Pakistan is a really wonderful thing. In America, we don't do that. You arrive here, you're American.
Right.
You can be as Pakistani as you want to be, but chances are American culture, you know, your kids are going to be one of us, you know. Mm. And so that multi-culti thing, I think, has led to ghettoization,
yeah.
in my humble opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a good idea, very respectful, but it hasn't really been such a blessing for the people for whom it was designed.
Yeah. Boy, I'm really depressed now.
Oh, man.
I'm not depressed.
You moved to California.
I can't. My wife loves New York, and I can't move my job to California where I grew up. I grew up in Northern California.
You with your job, Greg. Oh, come on over to California. The cannibals will be after you with their pitchforks.
It's so true. It's so true.
That I got to see.
Yeah. What are you doing right now? I pestered you enough. What are you working on? Where can people find you? And I know you're composing, and you're working with Adrian Ballou.
I'm a serious composer now, don't you know?
Exactly.
I've played music symphonies for orchestras. I'm an actual musician now.
Yeah.
And I'm all happy with that and very, very dignified. You know, the ice is very cold in the classical world. It's very dignified. But out of nowhere came this rock and roll album. Buddy called me up from Italy, and I go down there and with Adrian Ballou.
Amazing guitarist.
Yeah, and yeah. Mark King, mm-hmm. and my Italian buddy Vittorio Cosma, and we cut a record. And that was just so not part of my plan, but it's not bad if I say so myself.
What's it called?
An anti-single.
What's it called?
On Monday. Was that yesterday?
No.
Whatever it was, the beginning of this week.
Yeah.
It's there on YouTube. It's called Amaka Pipa, and the band is called Gizmodrome.
Okay.
And it's actually kind of pertinent. It's about anger. It's about everybody's angry. And so is whoever that guy singing is, probably me, shouting into the microphone. It's raging. It's called Amaka Pipa. And the punchline is, I'm more Amaka Tancho.
Mm.
Loosely translated, I'm more American than you. I'm more American than you. I'm more Amaka Tancho. I'm more Amaka Tancho. I'm more Amaka Tancho.
I think we should end on that note, Stuart, as always. So are you going on tour?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, the record's, you know, we're starting to put out tracks now on Spotify and so on and
okay.
YouTube. And the record will come out in September, and then there'll be a tour. And get this, folks, I'm going to be out in the front of the stage banging a guitar and singing into that microphone.
That's awesome. And then you got to come on my show, the GG Show.
Absolutely.
Because you haven't been on. You were on like a couple of years, right when it started. And I don't even think
yeah.
I.
Well, yeah. No, I've been following your rise, Mr. Gutfield.
Yes.
The first time you had a humble little show at midnight or something like that. Next time I come back, you're like got a much more prime spot, yeah. and I can see you rising up there.
Yeah. Well, I'm working hard. I'm
yeah.
trying to keep my nose clean.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you're working too hard to keep your nose clean.
No, that's true.
I think you're working hard to burn it all down.
Yeah, that's half of my goal.
Insurrection.
Yes. Well, Stuart, always a pleasure to talk to you. And
yes.
I hope to see you very soon. And I'm going to go get your record.
Cool.
Awesome, man. Thank you.
All right.